The Art of the Wabanaki, the People of the First Light. Wabanaki basket makers are known far and wide for their intricate, beautiful baskets woven from the black ash tree. But the art of the Wabanaki extends far beyond basket weaving as well. Wabanaki artists are creating extraordinary jewelry and fashion, paintings, beadwork, dance, and singing. The skills are handed down through generations, and many artworks carry great symbolism. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we are going to learn more about the art of the Wabanaki. We'll also find out about the first annual Indian market to be held next month in Bar Harbor. It celebrates and highlights the art of Native cultures throughout North America. 75 Native artists representing 40 nations will take part. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Bangor, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Perhaps the best-known artwork made by the Wabanaki are their beautiful, intricate baskets, but there is also jewelry, prints, carvings, as well as film, music, and dance. We're going to hear about the role these arts have played in Maine and how people can learn more about Wabanaki art on today's program. Joining me in our Bangor studio, Cinnamon Catlin Lagoot. How do you pronounce your last name?
Lagutko.
I was going to do it wrong. She's president and CEO of the Abbey Museum. We have two Abbey Museum trustees and Wabanaki basket makers here with us as well, Gabriel Fry and Sarah Sockbason. We always want to hear from you. Have you ever seen different forms of Wabanaki art? Have you ever seen a basket weaver demonstrate his or her craft? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. And one of the reasons we're doing this program today, as opposed to another day, Cinnamon, is you have something really exciting that's going to happen at the Abbey next month, right?
We sure do. Coming up May 18 through 20 in Bar Harbor, we have the inaugural Abbey Museum Indian Market, a juried art show of Wabanaki artists, of course, but all across North America, artists have been invited to join us. So this is the first of its kind in Bar Harbor. It's a multi-day event with a marketplace for buying beautiful, beautiful art forms, but also a film festival, a fashion show, and a few other surprises are planned.
Okay. Well, I want to ask each of you how you got started into basket making. And Sarah, I know in a lot of families, it's passed down through the generations. Was that the case with you?
Yeah. So within my family, unfortunately, my great-grandmother, when she passed away, she was the last person who kind of had carried that knowledge within my immediate family. And my grandmother, which is her daughter, really, I don't think she had interest in learning how to make basketry. And so I've always been an artist. I have painted and played around with various different media growing up. And I really just knew I wanted to be an artist, but I didn't find my true passion until I met Jennifer Sapiel over at the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance. And she took me under her wing and taught me all the traditional processes. And I did an apprenticeship with her for about a year in 2004. And that's kind of how I got started, actually being able to access the knowledge.
Okay, what about you, Gabriel? How'd you get started?
Well, I learned from my grandfather, but it's the form that I learned was the sort of traditional utility baskets. Mm. But within my family, there's both the sort of the fancy baskets, which Sarah does, and then the utility baskets, which are more like functional pack baskets, fishing creels, things like that.
I love you say fancy basket. So that's sort of the official term.
Yeah.
So, and these are the ones you see little loops and different colors, and they may not have a practical purpose. They're a piece of art that you're going to put on your mantelpiece.
Yeah. So they kind of started out more utilitarian over the times, and eventually they've more evolved into kind of their own art form. And so everybody, like in our communities, call them fancy baskets because they're like the fancy ones. They're the ones that are more eye-catching. And a lot of them were kind of geared towards like the tourist market. And so a lot of people wanted little trinkets that they could take home from Maine and things like that.
Yeah, if you look historically, the sort of the size of the baskets shrink down through the generations and like until you get something that's like, yeah, can literally be put in a suitcase and brought home. So,
And I want to talk about that history, Cinnamon, because I know that the market that's being created for May kind of has a heritage itself, that there used to be the period, was it referred to as the encampment period in Bar Harbor when, let me have you tell us about it.
Sure. We call it the Rusticator era on the island, but really it's the time when Wabanaki people were thriving with the cultural economy. It's the 1840s to the 1920s. Mount Desert Island is starting to boom as a tourism destination. And throughout all of that, Wabanaki people are there. They've always been on the island, and they engaged in the cultural economy as tourism was blooming. So those trinkets you talked about really take flight during that time period. The Victorian era really loved all kinds of niche things, and Wabanaki people responded. And so these encampments were located throughout town, and you could go visit an individual and get a guided tour with a Wabanaki person, whether on the water or on land, or you could buy some wonderful pieces, or you could just hang out and learn from others. And that's been an identity for the island forever. And so we really see the Indian market as a continuation of that. And certainly the festival we've been part of for about 25 years now, every July, is also a part of it. It's part of the story of MDI. It's a part of what people remember and take away. And it's what we really want to invest in as a museum.
All right. So what are you thinking about, Sarah, when you're conceiving of a basket? Are you thinking, I want to make something as beautiful as possible? Is there symbolism in these baskets that you're creating? Where are you coming from?
So initially when I design a piece, it starts before I even begin processing the material. Since the material requires so much prep work, I really can gain inspiration from anything when it comes to like color, design, fashion. I'll see a few colors that I think like will pair well and kind of work together within the basket form. And when I have that kind of vision, I'll just start prepping my material and try to achieve a desired look. But one thing that's really special about like the art form that we're doing is you can have an initial idea or inception, and as you weave, things kind of do their own thing. It's almost like magic, because you can have all the ideas in the world, but it always comes out different in the end.
Gabriel, you're nodding as she says that.
Because every tree has its own personality. So you can like start out a process thinking, oh, this is what it's going to do. But the material really guides you. And if you're paying attention, and most Wabanaki artists do, they don't force the tree to do anything. The tree sort of is what it is, and then you work with the material. And then, it oftentimes will inform what you're going to make.
My understanding is that the choice of the tree, the black ash or sometimes called brown ash, is something that is so essential to the Wabanaki culture, the origin story. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's tied to our entire creation story. There's a sort of mythical figure within our stories, Gluskab, who... before there were men, he fired an arrow into an ash tree, and when it split apart, within the bark was people today, the people of the Dawnland. So if you think about it in terms of like, that's the very sort of basis of our creation, and throughout history, the tree has, like basket making, has been sort of a tool for upward mobilization.
So when you're creating a basket out of one of these trees, is a basket sort of like a being of its own?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think what Sarah was also alluding to is like when you have an idea, you're also working in consort with this thing, this basket, but it's also it's a separate being. It becomes something else.
Wow.
I think also when you're working in very small, minute details at a time. You have to really follow the certain steps to get to a finished product. You're not looking at it as a whole. You're seeing each tiny step along the way, in almost like in a microscopic kind of way.
You know, we've just done some reporting recently. Maine Public's Barbara Caridi has a whole web special report on the emerald ash borer. Is this, I know it's not here yet, but most biologists expect it will be. Is this something that is worrisome for you all?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's at this point, it is sort of an inevitability, right? It's, you know, it's on our doorsteps. It's been slowly marching across the U.S. But even in areas where it has nearly decimated the population, the culture is still like, because basket making with black ash is across the U.S., right? So even in areas where it has decimated the population, they still are working with the material. And it's not like it's entirely gone. It's just,
okay. It's
just majorly devastated.
So harder to find.
Yeah.
Cinnamon, I want to ask you, we're talking a lot about basket weaving, and I know that, you know, the baskets from this part of the world are so famous. What else is this is famous from Wabanaki art? What would you know when you saw it and say that's a piece of Wabanaki, fill in the blank? Would it be beadwork? Would it be carving?
I would definitely say birch bark carving is a form that's so unique to this period. It sings from the trees almost in a way. You know, when you look at ash basketry, you see the technical aspects and you see how it's broken apart and reinvigorated, and that's extraordinarily wonderful. But then the birch bark baskets, or the containers rather, are really, I don't know, it's, they're bending more toward that, the feel of a tree. It's so woodland, it's very northeastern. You can almost smell it, feel it, touch it. And then they tell, usually, you see these wonderful carvings, they may tell stories, or they may tell just beautiful designs, but they're singing just as loudly as the ash basketry. I love them all, but I really find the birch bark basketry so unique to this part of the world, too.
All right. Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. So I understand you all give lots of demonstrations. You do. This is not an art that's necessarily in a private studio with the shades drawn and nobody watching. What's it like, Gabriel, to be at a craft fair or another kind of event, weaving in front of people and talking with people as you're weaving?
Well, unfortunately, it happens every single show, because I'm usually like up the entire night before trying to finish stuff and then packing it into a bin to get to the show in time for the opening. So I usually wind up weaving. But what I find happens most often is people are shocked. Like when you see a finished fancy basket, it's this gorgeous, magical object. But there's rarely a sense of how much, or even like understanding the process. You don't really know how much time and energy is put into every single minute step, every single curlicue, everything. Like, it's all a precision act. So when you do it in front of somebody, there's this sense of like, oh my God, it's this meditative process at the same time as like,
hard labor,
right? So it's pretty incredible, and I think that it's always an eye-opening experience for people to view it in process.
Sarah, what's the question you get most often when people see your work?
The question I get at every show, almost every person asks it, is how long did it take to make that? And that one, I would think that I would get tired of hearing it, but I kind of have just come to expect that people will ask that. And so that kind of gives me the opportunity to jump right in and start talking about our process and trying to educate people as much as I can about our traditions and about our art. And I think I've come to realize that there just aren't a lot of people that are familiar with this type of basketry. And, you know, I would think that it's been around for so long, people have maybe seen the more utilitarian type of pieces, but maybe they didn't connect that with who made it. And so nowadays, I think just as important to show people my art. I think it's equally as important to educate people about our process, our tradition, our cultural kind of art form.
Do you think there's, you know, I'm sitting here in a room, for those of you who can only imagine this studio, with three really, you know, young, vibrant people. And I think that there's sort of an idea that this is something that old people do, and that this is something that, you know, people who are clinging to a heritage, and I don't want to pull in too many stereotypes, but do you feel as though with your generation there's a resurgence in interest in this work?
Yeah, I do. Well, in the 90s, before kind of the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance got started, there was a real serious decline in the average age of a basket maker. So back then in the 90s, a few people noticed the average age was around 60 years old. So there weren't a lot of young people doing it. And it was usually because, I know for me anyway, I didn't have access to that familial tie. And even though I wanted to learn and it was something that is really culturally important, I just didn't have access to the knowledge. So it was really doing that apprenticeship is kind of what started it all for me. And I was really young. I was like 18 or 19. And for me, I just wanted to be an artist. And so once I kind of delved into the whole world of Wabanaki basketry, I really just found something that's like fulfilling, something that I want to wake up and do every day, something that I am really wanting to perpetuate for future generations so they'll have access to it as well.
And what about for you, Gabriel? You've got kids. Are they interested in what you're doing?
Well, yeah, my oldest daughter's 5, so she's very interested in everything. And at this point, she knows not to, you know, grab the knives or anything. But yeah, she wants to be a part of it all. But it is interesting, like you say, not having the familial ties. There's also the problem of having it be there and having it just be something. It's like the furniture in the room.
Yes. Right?
Something that's
yes.
been taken for granted.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I grew up surrounded by it and took it for granted, like for most of my life. I was around the same age, 18, and my grandfather was diagnosed with emphysema. And suddenly there's this time limit on this amazing wealth of information. Like, he's been doing it his entire life, and then generations before that. And suddenly there's this sense of like, this is fleeting. It's a precious thing that is not gonna be around forever.
What was your grandfather's reaction when you told him you wanted to learn from him?
Skepticism.
Really?
In one word, yeah. Well, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna go hang out with you and learn to bake baskets. He's like, all right, boy, the ash is downstairs. And I mean, that's it. So I'm like, okay. It took me a long time of like being there and cutting myself and, you know, getting splinters and blisters before he was like, okay, maybe he's serious. So there is, I mean, and I think it's, you know, obviously the years before of just, you know, coming and going at his house and not paying any attention to what he was doing.
So we do have to go to a break. I want to tell you, if you're near a computer, you can go to Maine Calling's Facebook page. Our producer, Cindy Hahn, has posted some pictures of both Gabriel and Sarah's art. You're going to be blown away. In the meantime, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can go to 1-800-399-3566. You can email us, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Wabanaki art and the role it plays. Joining me today, Gabriel Fry and Sarah Sockbason, who are both Wabanaki basket makers as well as trustees at the Abbey Museum in Bar Harbor. And Cinnamon, Catlin, Legatko, I don't know why I'm having such a hard time with
it's
your
Legatko.
Name. I'm so sorry. President and CEO of the Abbey Museum. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. tweet @MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, David Schultz, owner of Home and Away Gallery and author of Baskets of Time, Profiles of Maine Indian Basket Makers. David, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for letting me participate, Jennifer. And hello to Sarah
Why did
and
you...
Gabriel and Cinnamon.
So I want to ask you, David, why did you choose to write about Indian basket makers? What got you so interested, and what do you want the rest of the world to know?
Sure. Really, the short answer is it was about time that somebody did this, and I happened to be in the right place at the right time. We in the gallery deal with art from the Southwest, from the Arctic, and from Maine. And I have plenty of books, lots of books about Inuit artists and artists from the Southwest and so forth. And there are a few books about Maine Indian basketry, but most of them deal with traditional and older pieces. So I thought that it's about time that the Maine artists take their place among the, you know, the rest of the Native American artists across the continent in having their own, you know, book that highlights the contemporary artists.
What did you learn about the artists that you didn't know going into the project?
Oh, my gosh. The artists were so generous in sharing stories and knowledge. And I'll give you an example about Sarah. Sarah is such a perfectionist with her color. She and her boyfriend, Nick, talked about how she might take a week to come up with the right color for a particular basket, you know, to fulfill her vision of what it looks like. I learned, I'll use Gabriel as an example too. When he first started weaving, he felt he was able to do it without having had instructions. And he calls it cellular memory. So it was in his family for generations, and he was able to start doing it. And his mother was there, and she witnessed it, and she, you know, she acknowledges that as well. So I learned a lot of personal things about them, about their enthusiasm and their dedication and so forth. And one of the most important things is that the young artists have an incredible appreciation for the mostly women, Clara Kieser and Sylvia Gabriel and so forth, who were so generous in sharing their knowledge with the younger artists.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, David. David Schultz owns Home and Away Gallery and is the author of the book Baskets of Time, Profiles of Maine Indian Basket Makers. You know, within the last decade, I believe, the new museum opened at the Smithsonian, dedicated to the Native Americans in the United States. And then even right now, the Portland Museum of Art Biennial Exhibit features several Wabanaki artists. Do you believe, Cinnamon, that there is a renewed interest and recognition for Native art beyond the Abbey Museum, which is dedicated to Native art?
I would say, I think the mind that I'm in is that it's not necessarily a renewed interest, it's a recognition. It's a time is up on really setting Native art forms to the left, to the right. It's actually part of the art world, and distinguishing them separately is problematic. It becomes an othering, a difficult history, and museums and Native people historically don't have a great relationship. There's a lot of pain that's happened with museums historically, removing materials from communities, stealing materials, and the stories go on and on and on, so that museums have grown up in the U.S. and abroad as not being very comfortable places. So when you have the National Museum of the American Indian on the National Mall staking its claim and doing it a different way, it really matters. And the Abbey works in that shadow of work of really creating new relationships with Wabanaki artists, new relationships with Native people, and prioritizing their interests and their wishes and their life stories. So when you do that, it invites a much larger audience of whether they're collectors or museum goers or students. It's a much broader audience of people. It's more inclusive, and it brings people to the table. And hopefully they transition to lifelong collectors. And that's what we're focused on, is having that bigger open message about what this world could look like, should look like, and how Native art is right there in the middle of it, as well as anybody else's art.
And what about this idea? You know, I think a lot of people travel to the desert Southwest and come home with some jewelry, or go up to Canada and come home with some Inuit carvings and their treasured, you know, pieces of art in their home. And I'll ask you this, Gabriel, what is the relationship like among the different nations throughout North America? And is that changing as far as the art world within these communities?
Yeah, I think overall there's traditionally in the sort of like larger fine arts world, there's been this sort of like this awareness of Southwestern Native art. And part of that is our just the American culture of pan-Indianism, right? Like, you know, you see old Westerns and there's Indians in headdress and the pottery is mostly from the Southwest or, you know. And I mean, it's probably a better question for Sarah because she was one of the sort of the pioneers of going out to the Southwestern shows, which are like, you know, really well-established art shows and creating a presence of Eastern basket makers and artists in the Southwest, which, you know, now it's a really large sort of part of those Southwestern shows.
Sarah, how many years ago was it that you took your baskets to the Southwest?
The first time I did was in 2005. I went to a show at the Heard Museum, and that was initially kind of my introduction, and I had just kind of started, so I didn't really... I don't think I really absorbed it fully back then and what it was all about. But now another return was to Santa Fe Indian Market, and that's probably one of the oldest and largest Indian markets in the country. And going out there was just a really eye-opening and kind of inspiring experience because out there it's the best of the best artists in the entire country, and so, or in the world actually, for Native art. So when you go there and you get to go to the award show and you get to see the best of the best, it's so inspiring, and it really gives you hope for carrying on a cultural art, you know, when you see other people being like really enthusiastic about it and putting a contemporary spin on things. And I think the most important part for me as an artist is portraying my vision and my voice accurately, because, you know, I don't think what I do is based in a certain time period, even though it's traditional and this tradition has been evolving over time. I like to kind of do my own rendition because I'm a person who's grown up in the kind of modern world and have had access to everything just like everyone else. And so I think forever Native people have always been utilizing what they have available to them in creative ways, and I think that's kind of the next wave of creativity.
Yeah, I think that's an easy sort of like trope to get sort of sloughed into, is that sort of like Native art exists in this one time frame of like it is, if you're using anything, if you're using metal tools, then somehow it's not traditional, or, you know, but really like Indigenous art is art that's created by Indigenous people, and oftentimes that voice reflects what's happening in the world today.
Is there any kind of debate going on? Are there people who only use traditional tools and that's kind of their thing?
Well, I mean, I think that's always a part of the conversation. I wouldn't call it a debate. But okay. There is always this sort of like, if you work with birch bark, then it's somehow more traditional than ash basket making because you have to use metal tools, or, you know, it's like, and there's always... from observers, there's always like, well, what did you do before you had an axe? You know,
yeah.
It's sort of you're not allowed to evolve your methodology.
We'll go to Richard, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call, Jennifer. I appreciate this program very much, but I'm always worried about the natural resources and the changes that are happening here. You explained about the brown black ash. I'm wondering, how do you identify that wood, number one? And number two, what about sweetgrass supplies? I've heard that they are in short supply as well.
I'd be willing to take that. So I wouldn't call sweetgrass in short supply. I think the tradition of open access to the areas where sweetgrass grows has changed and evolved. Right now, Acadia National Park is doing an environmental impact study on opening up its lands to Indigenous harvesters, so creating a sustainable way of harvesting that within those public lands. So that's sort of in the works for the future. And then as far as...
I mean, more and more places are being developed and things like that. So that's how a lot of the sweetgrass areas are being in short supply, I guess. But also when it comes to brown ash, I think our biggest fear is the ash borer beetle, because we know it's inevitable that it will be here eventually. And so I know in terms of what I harvest, I personally only will harvest 1 to 2 trees a year, and that's all that I'll personally need. But the threat of the ash borer beetle has really, it's made me think about our resources in a different way, and thinking about what we can do that's more proactive than just sitting back and waiting for this beetle to come.
Yeah, no, that's entirely accurate. I think there is something. I mean, the traditional method of harvesting ash is itself sustainable. It's a sustainable harvesting. Like, it needs a high canopy and shade to get established, and then it also needs like direct sunlight to really like grow and become a large tree. So the human interaction within an ash stand, cutting down 1 or 2 trees, often most harvesters don't go in and cut down an entire ash stand. It's 1 or 2 trees at a time. And, you know, it's that sort of like understanding that you're a custodian of your environment. You're not like there to take all of the resources and then move on to another place, right? So I think it's in that sense, the continued sort of relationship in land is sustainable. And then you have the prices of globalization and bringing in insects that don't have any natural predators.
And I think also the natural or the traditional process of harvesting has also been passed down. So that's knowledge that we know how to do it right, how to sustain it for the future generations.
Richard, thanks so much for your call. Francis on Twitter tweets, "The more I see the steps Sarah and Gabe put into their art, the greater appreciation I have for their work. Every artist is different and has specific ways they prepare their ash. Although the same art form, they're styled so differently. You always see something new." Thank you, Francis, for that. Another tweet, "What kind of fashion show will be at the Abbey Museum Indian Market?"
Well, that's an exciting topic, because Native fashion is hot right now. It has been a reclamation of design and fashion forms that for generations has been dominated, you know, outside of the Native world. And right now, Native designers are really making a stand also about what designs mean and how it can be used and how those clothing forms take shape. So you have seen now at these other shows, like we've mentioned, fashion really revving up the audience and getting people excited about this contemporary nature of art. So we knew when we started the Indian Market, we wanted to start with fashion. We didn't want to wait a couple years. So we're going to have 3 designers this year. DeConte and Brown, which is a Penobscot husband and wife team who do incredible work. They will be debuting a line on Saturday, the 19th at 1 o'clock. And then 2 other designers will take the runway. Akinav, which is a really well-known label, will be there. And then a partnership between Don Spears, who's an Narragansett fashion designer and is also the producer of our Indian Market, and OXDX, which does some amazing screen printing t-shirts, this kind of ready-to-wear look, will be part of the show.
Great.
I'll also have a couple of purses in the fashion show.
Right. There's a little fun thing happening Friday night. Thank you for reminding me. We have a big kickoff party Friday night at the 18th. And all this information, of course, is on our website about all the details. But there'll be an accessory show that night. And some of Gabriel's work will be there, too.
Diane on Facebook says, "I have a basket of my grandmother's made in Washington County sometime in the early 1900s. Will there be a table at the event in Bar Harbor in May where people can bring an old basket to learn more about them?"
Oh, like an antiques roadshow.
Yeah, you know, we have done that from time to time at the Abbey. And that's a good reminder. We need to make sure we have somebody around the booth. There will be an Abbey booth within the marketplace. And that's the place to stop. And if there isn't somebody there, we will get you somebody who can help you understand it.
Or find a basket.
Yeah.
Or find a basket maker.
That's great. So you can tell by looking at a basket, you have a sense of...
You can get a sense of the family, but there's also sort of like, I guess what they would call in the antiques community, the prestige around the piece, right? If it's from Washington County, it's a Passamaquoddy piece. But then you can oftentimes get a sense of what family did it, because there's always this a certain style it's not owned by the family, but people understand that this, like, this family did this.
Like and a so, certain shape or a certain combination of colors?
A certain combination of colors. The way that the points are done, sometimes they're really long, sometimes they're really tight, and it's, you know, it's oftentimes, it's not something you can necessarily characterize into words, like describing it, but when you see it, you're like, oh, that's a Keyser basket.
Or, oh, that's so neat. Well, guess what? We have to take another break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the variety and meaning of Wabanaki art. And joining me today, Cinnamon Catlin Legutko, Gabriel Frey, and Sarah Sockbasin. They're all with the Abbey Museum, and Gabrielle and Sarah are basket makers. Their work, we've posted pictures on our Facebook page. You've got to check it out. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. A few minutes ago, Cinnamon, we were talking about taking Wabanaki art to these big festivals and big shows out west. How are they received?
Oh my gosh, it's so exciting. We've been watching it closely at the Abbey, and not only are Wabanaki artists showing up in numbers now, but they're taking top prizes. A lot of these juried shows have competition. We're not starting with that with our Indian market. We'll do that in a couple years, but they have competitions where it's best of the best, and then categories. Wabanaki artists have been taking the top for about 5 years now, whether in the classification or the best of show. And not to overstate it, it's a really big deal. And that doesn't happen here in the homeland. And that's our intent, is to really return that excellence here where Wabanaki people are, where they have always been for more than 12,000 years, and where they continue this knowledge.
We have an email from Jen. In the same way that paintings give insight into historical events and periods, do these baskets reflect history?
Oh, definitely. If you look at the earlier pieces, even in birch bark, so they really evolved from a utilitarian purpose. So those pieces were made for gathering various different things. And so as time evolved, the baskets evolved, and, you know, as more materials kind of became the norm utilizing, the baskets changed. And so you can look at older pieces and you can actually see what materials they had newly discovered, what was innovation at the time. And as you kind of move through the years, you can look at pieces and you can know exactly what time period they were from because of the materials they were trying to incorporate. And so I think even now, when you look at the baskets that we call fancy baskets, not only have they shrunk down, but I know a lot of people who are utilizing kind of more modern materials. And so it's kind of where the evolution has always been trending towards, just changing over time, and you can really see it when you look at the older pieces.
Yeah, even within like the utility baskets, you can generally like get a sense of what was happening in the state. Like up north, you have an entire range. Like the Aroostook County is basically synonymous with potato baskets, right? If you go down towards the coast, where the fisheries were a huge thing, you have scale baskets. And it's sort of like a reflection of, like, I guess back, you know, at the turn of the century, it wasn't an individual artist making a basket. It was sort of like the community getting together and creating an industry. So there was a lot of scale baskets, larger sort of like uniform shapes. And you'd see like the differences of like the individual canneries having a their number letter on it.
Let's see. We'll go to Michael calling from Owl's Head. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. I picked up a utility round basket from Richard Silly Boy. And, of course, the wood is nice and fresh and all nice colored. But what do I do to protect the basket from water damage? Do you guys use oil or a wax? Or what do you guys suggest?
I would So one of the things is a lot of people like to seal their baskets, and I encourage you not to. If you let it just have a natural moisture exchange, it will last longer because you may seal the wood to waterproof it against moisture, but you then make the wood brittle. So if you think about it in terms of it's a wetland species, it's designed sort of like for that natural sort of moisture exchange. So yeah, just don't leave it outside in a puddle and it'll be all set. Right.
So really how to care for one of your baskets is to maybe dust it, but otherwise leave it alone?
Yeah.
Well, if it's a utility basket, somebody's going to be using it. And what's awesome is that some of the packed baskets that I've had in my family have lasted for generations and generations.
Continuous use.
continuous use, exactly. And so it's amazing how strong and durable they are. Like specifically the ash is a very flexible wood. So it's it can absorb water. It's really, made to be out in the elements, I guess.
Yeah. Its strength is the flexibility. That's really like the main part of it. And so when you seal it, which a lot of people are like, this is the best way to take care of it because maple, oak, all of those more harder woods, that's what they do. They, you know, protect it from moisture. But that immediately makes it brittle.
Doesn't have access to water anymore. Yeah. And even when I work out west, I'll bring all my supplies and the wood will be so brittle because it's constantly being dried out by the sun and it's so dry there, the dry air. Whereas when I come home, it's like the natural moisture in the air. The wood likes it. It absorbs it and it's flexible and it's as brittle. But one thing that I have told people, especially with utilitarian pieces, I don't know if you've done this before, Gabe, but I've used kind of a mixture of a few oils and beeswax and kind of just like rubbed it on the side of pieces just to make it even more flexible and so it's not as brittle.
Yeah.
Something that, you know, like you would moisturize your skin with.
Yeah, more or less.
Michael, thanks so much for your call. We'll move on to Mike. Mike, where are you calling from?
Hollowell.
Mike? Oh, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, awesome. So, thank you. Well, you may have just answered the first part of my two-part question. I was going to ask why ash is the most desirable species for basketry. Is it because of the way you work it? Is it easily worked, or does it just last the longest? The second part of my question was, if you didn't have access to ash, what would be your second choice? Which species or which family of trees would be your second choice for basket making if you didn't have any ash?
So the second part to that is I consider myself not just a basket maker, but a Passamaquoddy basket maker, which is the form of ash basket making. So I probably wouldn't make baskets if there were no more ash around.
See, I have a whole different take, and this is because I see myself as an artist first and foremost. And so as an artist, I take advantage of all the materials I have available to me at any time. And so I think I couldn't imagine being out without ash because that is, I think it's the most special material I've ever worked with in my life. And the reason why that is because when you're processing a tree, it gets pounded continually until the growth rings separate. And so once those growth rings separate, they peel off the tree. And I've done experiments where we've taken a white ash or similar splint type trees and tried to pound it and see, just to see if we could utilize the material. And the thing was, it acted like ash where it split apart when you pounded it. However, it was very brittle. So you couldn't twist it and bend it and do all the more intricate things that I personally do. But ash is definitely not a material that can ever be replaced. However, for me, I think I'm always experimenting with new materials. And I think that's, the evolution of what our art form has always been doing. So I think I would just play with what I had available.
Okay, I'm going to try. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, in the South, the Cherokee use white oak, which I've heard from basket makers who've used both white oak and ash that the properties are very similar.
Oh, interesting. We're going to try to squeeze in one more call. Meg in Parsonsfield. Hi, Meg. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I'm curious about the dyeing process, and you may have already discussed it, but I'm curious about the materials that are used for dyeing, and I'll take my answer off air.
Do you want to go first?
So you should talk about the natural process and sort of the where it began.
So yeah, I've always been extremely resistant to using color at all, and my wife got me sort of like on the dye wagon of like, but you know, through using natural dyes. So I use madder root, logwood, a fermented rock tripe or a lichen, indigo, sort of just all plant-based dyes, and then experimenting a lot with using different mordants to change the pH and, you know, really get a different sort of like hues and tones and everything. And I think the most exciting thing about that is you don't know what you're going to get. Like, you know, a general sense, but it always comes out, you know, it's always a surprise. So that's something that I find exciting. But
what about you, Sarah? What do you use?
Well,
specifically, one thing a lot of people don't realize is how much chemistry goes into the dyeing process. So especially if you're using different types of dyes. So for me, I primarily will use two different types of commercial dyes. So I'll use either an acid-based or an alkaline-based dye. And it kind of depends on the colors that are available on the market. But I've also experimented with natural dyes. And I'm always learning about the chemistry of the dyeing process and how pH changes things and how you can basically also formulate colors. Like, I've formulated shades, you know, that I had in my head, and it's another thing to actually get the wood that color. So I'm constantly playing around with the dyeing process. And what's nice is the ash, because it's so white, it will actually absorb most colors if you have the right fixative or the right chemical mixture. So I think color has always been important for me as an artist, because that's kind of like how I can express who I am as an artist and being in our modern times. So I don't ever confine myself to specifically natural dyes or certain colors. Uh-huh. I go out and do whatever I want.
Well, that's going to have to be the last word. So interesting and so great to meet all of you. That was Sarah Sockbasin. She is a basket weaver and Abbey Museum trustee, as is Gabriel Frey. Also here with us, Cinnamon Catlin Legutko, president and CEO of the Abbey Museum. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. We had additional help from Steve Tilton and Rich Tozier. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.